It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, and this week Martin Summers and I take a step back from the news review and take a longer view of politics, economics, and history. Martin, I mean, we do this news review every week. We're doing it for something like three and a half years now. But I think it's important sometimes to do that thing where we take a step back. To be quite frank, you know, we're not able this time to talk about the news this week because the show is pre-recorded. But looking at the wider view, let's start with economics and the economy, because I know one of the things that you've said on the show many times is that there is almost a deliberate attempt to blind the public with science of economics. So, I mean, do you think that's something that you still attest to?
I think so, yes. If people think about mainstream news programmes, the business news is at the very end of the programme and a series of jargonistic statements are made, which are often deliberately misleading, and most people have switched off by that stage and are waiting for whatever's coming on next. And the general philosophy behind all of this is it's not for the likes of you, you don't really understand it, so we're just giving you a brief explanation so that you won't have to bother your silly little heads about it, and next up is the Super Bowl or whatever it is.
Well, we had Ian Fraser, the blogger. He's quite a fan of his because he tends to talk very straight on several times, and he's saying that there is actually a very close relationship with financial correspondents in the National Press in London and the city itself. I mean, is that something that you would agree with?
Well, of course there is. Let's face it, it's a closed loop. Partly it's to do with financial matters. In other words, people know which side their bread's buttered on. If you go out saying too many controversial things, you won't be called back. And partly it's to do with groupthink, because if everybody in your circle talks in a certain kind of way and presumes that certain kinds of things are unsayable or taken for granted, then eventually that creates a sort of mental block for people even within the financial services industry and their interlocutors in the media, preventing them from understanding what's going on.
Because it sounds like a bit of a tug of war, really, between the public, the needs and the wishes of the public, and the city. And the media is somewhere in the middle. Obviously, the word media does mean in the middle. How does that actually play out in reality? What kind of methods do the banks, the City of London, have to actually co-opt the media, other than what we've just been saying?
Well, let's start with the absolutely obvious. Most of the media is owned by very wealthy people who've got a lot of money invested in the city.
Yeah, this is a point I've made quite a bit.
It bears repeating because it's a pretty obvious one, but it certainly makes a big difference.
Well, people tend to blame journalists a lot, but then I'm always pointing out, well, the journalists don't own the printing presses, the journalists don't own the transmitters.
No, they don't. And of course, journalists who want to be successful in that world have to actually say the kind of things that those who do own those things want to hear. It is possible to be critical financial journalists. I wouldn't suggest that it isn't. And, for example, the Financial Times often employs people, and The Economist often employ people who are not part of what you might call the mainstream of economic thinking. But even those people have to work within certain parameters, otherwise they're not going to be taken seriously. And don't forget, this is a rather specialised market. Most ordinary people aren't interested in the detail of the financial news. It's only since the financial crisis, really, that they've been forced to confront the fact that they need to know something at least about it. Because when there was no financial crisis, many people presumed that this didn't concern them, just as if people aren't interested in football, switch over when that comes on.
Well, I mean, as a journalist myself, I'm a big fan of the iNewspaper. It's cheap, it's only 20 pence during the week. And also, you do tend to get quite a lot of stuff which does poke at the government and the city, but in a very constructive way. It's illustrating for the public. It's doing its job, really, as a public service, much more, it seems to me, than some of the other newspapers. But really, the only way to do this is what we do every Friday, which is to look at stories from all of the newspapers, including sometimes the Morning Star, sometimes the Daily Telegraph. So, I mean, we do get a skewed picture because many of the most wealthy, the plutocrats, really do own the newspapers. They have an extreme amount of influence. They use lawyers to close down stories. For example, if a story is bubbling along behind the scenes, about to be printed, which is critical of them, you can bet your bottom dollar that the day before it goes to print, that the editor will get a lawsuit through the door, an injunction, basically, telling him he's not allowed to print this, and pointing out factual inaccuracies from the person that's in this news article's point of view. I mean, for example, individuals like Conrad Black, who used to own the Daily Telegraph, was well known as being incredibly litigious. And these people have their own intelligence systems for getting information to them about when there might be a critical story written about them. This is a real big dilemma for journalists, because, of course, if you're trying to present something in a balanced way, you want to present both sides. I mean, for example, on our Friday shows, I've invited Peter Hargreaves from Hargreaves Lansdown to come and speak several times, Martin. Just don't get a reply. What you get is not a yes or a no. You just invite them and then they don't get back to you. That's what's happened with Hargreaves Lansdown. We've tried to give their point of view. It's just been impossible. But ultimately, this does skew the way that the financial crisis has been presented to the public. So can you give us your alternative, in a way, decoded view of what's really been going on since 2008 and possibly a bit before?
Well, I think that's about right. I mean, if you looked at the financial press before the crisis, you would have found an enormous amount of complacency about the situation. And an obvious pointer to that was that Gordon Brown, the then Prime Minister, going to the City of London the week before the crisis broke, saying what a fantastic job they were all doing and how well organised it all was. Now, that was clearly wrong, but he was actually speaking from within a consensus which had established itself right across the what I would call the elite classes about what was going on.
I mean, is it
and therefore, when the crisis broke, they were shocked and awed. Of course, others were not shocked and awed. Those who'd been criticising from the sidelines, as it were not at all surprised, and I would be one of those. I mean, to my mind, it was fairly obvious what was going to happen. But don't forget, they often convince themselves, so that they can convince others, that capitalism is an incredibly stable system, and it's inevitable, and it's part of human nature. And the Black-Scholes theorem and the derivatives market had particularly created this illusory sense of having conquered previous uncertainties, all of which was blown away in a morning. And what's astonishing to me all these years later is that they are still fighting a rearguard action to defend theories which were basically sunk without trace in 2008, but they're still being pushed because of the mental inflexibility associated with a lot of economics training in universities. And of course, then that leads to people being employed in the city. And once you're in the city, don't forget what the city sells is optimism. That's what they're selling. And that's part of your job, if you are working in the city, is to go out and sell optimism. I mean, when you're trying to sell something to somebody, whatever it is, you're selling them optimism, the price is right. You should buy what I'm selling. So that's why there's a natural bias in the system towards optimism, because that's what they're selling.
But I'm fascinated by this picture you paint of Gordon Brown, talking about how wonderful the system was, how it was all brilliant, and then the next minute everything crashes down around his ears and he's in a panic. He doesn't know what to do, and he's kind of bounced into a solution which has almost in a way been pre-prepared. But is it really that simple, that it's a kind of an emperor's new clothes situation where nobody dares to actually say a few basic criticisms, as you've just done, to the city elite? I mean, we're talking about the people in the Guildhall, the people who are owners and controllers of the banking institutions in the city. Because the City of London is like a kind of city state, isn't it? A state within a state.
Well, if I can unpack that slightly, Keynes used to speak about markets as functioning like beauty contests. Now, beauty contests in the 1930s, when Keynes was talking about this, weren't beauty contests like we have now, where they were in the newspapers and you were given 10 pretty women to look at and you had to put them in order of preference, your order of preference, and you won if you put them in the same order of preference as the judges. Now, in other words, if you're operating in a market, you don't make money by being right but in the minority. You make money by guessing what everybody else is thinking. Soros has pointed out this out. George Soros has pointed out this is the problem of reflexivity of markets. So in other words, we don't just sit, if you're participating in any market, you don't just sit there thinking, well, I think it's worth so-and-so when in my calculations and in the long run it's going to be worth so-and-so. What you do is you look at the figures, you look at what everybody else is thinking, and of course, if you guess right that you think the same as everybody else, you will make money. If you guess wrong and you don't think the same as everybody else, you will lose money. So can you see there's a bias built into the way markets function towards overshoot and undershoot? When a bandwagon is rolling, either up or down, a bear or a bull bandwagon, you'd be a fool not to be on it. In actual fact, as long as the market keeps rising, you're sensible and rational to stay in the game, even if you think in the long run it's going to crash. But of course, the question is, at what point do you leave the game? It's the same problem you have when you're gambling. You've made a big pile of money. Should I leave now or should I carry on? And of course, actually, you should leave now, but often people don't, because as long as the market's going up, it's very hard to lose money.
Just explain these terms, bull and bear market.
Well, a bull market is when prices are rising, stock markets are going up. A bear market is the opposite, when they're going down.
Well, I mean, this is what's happened through quantitative easing, it seems to me, and maybe you disagree with me, but I mean, that seems to have been allowing a lot more money to be invested in stocks and shares, and so generally speaking, the market's gone up. How does that relate to what's actually really going on the ground with businesses? Are they actually really doing any better? I mean, because obviously you look at, say, your average business that's listed on the stock exchange, share price is creeping up. But is the business itself in any more of a healthy form? Or is it just that this money is chasing somewhere to invest and it seems that that's the only place?
Well, you've just about put your finger on it. I mean, basically, the relationship between stock markets and the real world was always tenuous. And of course, what you find is that periodically the real world and the stock market collide in things like crashes, like 1929. But in fact, the relationship between the stock market and the real world now is far more tenuous than it ever was. And that is to do with financial engineering, and also to do with quantitative easing. I mean, the whole purpose of quantitative easing is, in fact, to provide a safety net for the stock market so that it doesn't crash. But of course, that, in fact, masks the fact that the real economy is not nearly in the kind of shape that the stock market suggests that it ought to be in if it's going to be booming in the way it has been. And of course, we're recording this now to be played some weeks after we've spoken, and it could well be that the crash will have taken place after we record this broadcast.
Okay, going back a bit further from the 2008 crash, back to the 1980s, this is one thing which is cited by a lot of people as being really the lighting the blue touch paper initially before the 2008 crash. What was the big bang that happened in the 1980s under the Thatcher government? What was going on?
Well, in the past, people have got used to the idea that stock markets are absolutely central to the functioning of the economy. And the fact of the matter is that they're not. You can have a non-capitalist economy. You can have a capitalist economy, which has actually got very little stock market activity going on in it. So I would think of, Germany and Japan were famous for running their businesses without massive stock market in both countries. So many German and Japanese firms, for example, simply don't issue shares. They don't issue shares to outsiders.
Well, I know one of those, for example, is BMW. It's a family company.
Yeah.
The family happens to be the Quants. The Quants happened to make all their money in the Second World War in a company that's now Varta Batteries, making batteries for submarines with forced labour. And this is one of the controversies, is that, you know, this is, even though it's a family firm, the family actually made their money through slave labour in World War II.
Yeah, I mean, those are wider questions. But the fact is that you can have a very successful capitalist economy which doesn't have a massive stock market. That was the case for many years. In Britain and America, the idea that stock markets are absolutely essential and vital is more common.
I mean, for the elites
in Germany and Japan were very suspicious of stock markets. So stock markets are all very well. They've got their advantages, but they've got big disadvantages.
Well, the big disadvantage being, well, if you're a family business, you don't necessarily want your business to be, sunk or on the vagaries of the markets. If someone rumour goes around and suddenly people destroy your share price, you don't really want your business to collapse.
It's a bigger question than that. There's also the belief in Germany and Japan that long-term relationships between suppliers and customers, workers and so on, are more important. The problem with the deal-based capitalism found in the Anglo-Saxon countries is that there's no commitment on either side. Now that means there's great flexibility. You can hire and fire quickly. You can change your suppliers. Nobody's got any loyalty to anybody else. But the German and Japanese approach after World War II was, no, we want long-term relationships. What we're really interested in is technological change. We want a system that actually pushes technological change. And for that to happen, the engineers, the boffins, need to actually have a solid superstructure around them that means that they can make long-term plans. So, for example, you saw Japan after World War II basically devastated, going through several phases. The first phase was they'd already become a major textile producer before the war, so they moved from textiles into electronics. People may not remember this, but when the Japanese first started to move into the electronics industry after World War II, people laughed at them and they said they'll never be able to compete with the US companies. But of course, the laugh in the end was with them. And so they moved into electronics, and then from electronics onto the other more high-tech things that they subsequently did. And that is because they see the whole thing as a technological race. And that's partly to do with the history of Germany and Japan trying to catch up with the West and also needing the military technology to confront the West. So the idea of having a plan is not regarded as irrational at all in that kind of circumstance. Whereas, of course, in the Anglo-Saxon countries, the ideology is of freewheeling free market capitalism. The reality is of massive government spending, particularly on weaponry in the United States. But we're talking about differences of emphasis here rather than complete differences of social system. I mean, all of these are capitalist techniques, but they are quite varied.
Well, let's get back to the Big Bang, though, the 1980s, because I know one of the very first things that was brought in by in 1979, 1980, by the new Conservative Thatcher government, which really dominated the 1980s, the whole of the 1980s scene, was exchange controls. And then a few years later, the Big Bang. So can you take us through the impact that taking down exchange controls, which presumably had something to do with the eventual dominance of the EU and cross-border trade, you know, the single market programme, things like that, and then eventually, a few years later, the Big Bang itself?
Well, if you to understand that, you've got to go back to the end of the Second World War and the creation of the Bretton Woods system in 1946, which was basically it was a system to try and control international capital flows.
Well, this is the birth of the IMF.
The birth of the IMF, the birth of the World Bank, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. Those were the three main institutions that were set up. And the purpose of this was to make sure that there wouldn't be destabilising crashes as we'd seen in the 30s, which then led to the Second World War and so on. So the idea was that currencies would be fixed against each other by governments so that, you know, basically governments would have control over their own currency policy. There would be flexibility in the system because all currencies would trade within the system in relation to the dollar, and the dollar itself would be pinned to gold. So that allowed wriggle room. You could wriggle your currency against the dollar, and the dollar could be wriggled against gold, but only by agreement. And basically, therefore, you know, forex speculation was very difficult. And there were various techniques for ensuring this, including exchange controls. You couldn't take large amounts of money out of Britain until 1979. But of course, the Bretton Woods system fell apart in the early 70s because the United States basically abused their bankers' role in the system to carry on spending money when they oughtn't to have done, in order to try, in a hopeless attempt, to defeat the North Vietnamese Communist Party. They failed. And of course, in failing, they also bust the Bretton Woods system. So we then went back to a system more similar to what had happened before the Second World War, where big capital flows could take place, governments lost control over their currencies. And of course, it was the British government that pushed a lot of this. So when you hear conservative commentators now complaining about loss of sovereignty to Brussels, the biggest loss of sovereignty by Britain was giving up exchange controls and the capacity to direct Britain's economic policy from Britain at that stage. And the big bang in the city basically allowed anybody to come in and buy stuff in the city, and, you know, in other words, turned it into a big international market. It had always been a big international market, but it got rid of all sorts of checks and balances that had been involved to try and prevent things. You know, some of these derivative contracts which have been written since, they would never have been allowed under the old setup.
I mean, as I remember it, there was one very important rule to avoid corruption was that the same company could not do a deal and trade on the stock market that was actually dealing at the front end with clients. Say, for example, if I wanted to do to buy some shares or sell some shares, I would have to go to one institution, which would then talk to another institution, which would do the deal, which would then give the share certificate back to the original institution to me. So the idea was that there had to be this gap between, otherwise, of course, you know, there may be some funny business going on, some dodgy dealing, and that all went out the window, didn't it? So was that actually, what was that and what going on there? Was it a valuable thing to have?
Yes, it was. And in the US, they had what was called the Glass-Steagall Act, which essentially barred the banks from being involved in speculative activity. So you'd have what the equivalent of what we'd now call hedge funds did exist, but they weren't allowed to function as banks. And the Glass-Steagall Act had been brought in by the Roosevelt administration in the 30s as part of the whole cleanup program that had gone on in the 30s. There'd been a lot of reform of financial markets by governments because of the failures of 1929.
So you seem to be saying that we've basically written off all the lessons that were learned in the 1930s.
Absolutely. And this was obvious to those of us at the time who were being trained by... I was at Oxford University in the late 70s, and we were basically told that what was being done was counter to economic theory as we understood it. And in many ways, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and the people around them, like Sir Keith Joseph and other monetarist economists like Milton Friedman and so on, were regarded in the mainstream at that stage as fairly cranky and rather dangerous. And of course, they were. In actual fact, with the hindsight, we can now see that it was all wrong. In actual fact, we were setting off on the wrong road at that point. And we had Margaret Thatcher dying last year and all these eulogies to her from various people. In actual fact, she destroyed Britain's manufacturing base. We won't get it back. And our great-grandchildren and great-grandchildren will pay the price of that awful policy failure. And there's no point thinking that we can get it back now. We're not going to be able to run the radio back and do it differently. We should have done it differently. If we behaved in more sensible, moderate fashion, Britain would be a different place today.
I mean, what we were told in the 80s was that actually now Britain was going to become amazing. There was going to be the financial industry, and this was going to save us. In fact, of course, much of what the government takes in tax revenue, it takes from this financial industry. I mean, is it fair to talk about the City of London as an industry?
You can. I mean, there's some things that go on there which would have to be done under any setup, so you can call it an industry. But the fact is that the crash of 2008 and the knock-on consequences have long ago led to bigger losses to the British taxpayer than anything we've gained from money paid through as taxes when the bubble was going up. It's delusionary. The idea that you can, I mean, if you think about it for a minute, people buying shares in the hope that they can sell them the next day at a 20% profit, that is not a sustainable way to run a country.
Well, very interesting. We seem to be sort of slowly going backwards in time, but looking back at the 1930s now, what are the warning signs that you see now that mean that a similar kind of crash, a worse crash than took place in 2008, might be around? I mean, what were the things that were learnt from the 1929 crash that now we need to be relearning?
Well, I think in actual fact, the danger of a crash, and as I say, we're pre-recording this, and it may already have happened by the time this goes out, the danger of a crash now is worse than in 1929. In 1929, the financial markets were not nearly as integrated as they are now. So although catastrophic as it was, governments, for example, still had balanced books, mostly, and they were able to step in and take up the slack. The main problem in the 1920s and 30s was lack of intellectual and political will to deal with the crisis. Once the intellectual and political will was found as a result of the war coming over the horizon, then it was fairly easy for governments to get their finger out and do something. But what's happened this time is that governments have been suckered into bailing the banks out for several years, which actually means that their resources are being run down completely. And when the crash comes this time, there's nothing in the locker to deal with it. And we're going to go to a straight social fight between those with money and those without. There won't be any solution whereby, for example, the government can spend a bit more money, tax a bit more heavily, and reboot the economy. That won't be on. It'll be a straight fight. The wealthy classes will have the money. They shouldn't have it because they've basically stolen it, not through doing anything worth doing, but just through rigging the system. And the rest of us will have to take it off them. They will try and prevent it. And that will involve a great deal of bloodshed all over the world. And people think I'm joking about that. Take a look around. Bloodshed is already going on.
Okay. Well, also, there is another aspect to all of this, and that is the quality of money itself. I mean, money began simple, like little bits of coins of valuable precious metals with the king's head or whatever stamped on there. And slowly but surely, it's become something very different. I mean, for a start, we went off the gold standard, so the money wasn't exchangeable for a piece of gold anymore. You know, we had traditionally in England, we had the sovereign, which was a piece of gold, which was worth, I think, about a pound, wasn't it? Originally, and that was what the pound note or whatever it was in your bank account was equivalent to, and you could exchange it for that anytime you wanted to. Then we came off of that, and now we've got this sort of digital money which has got absolutely no real relation to gold. In fact, we know that there's many billions of quantitative easing money has been spent in. That's got no relationship to anything of any real value. So we've come further and further away from something which has got any real value at all, Martin. Now, just explain, I mean, what does that mean for us now? Because it does seem to me that we're getting more and more into a sort of fantasy world about whether that money that we've got in our bank account is actually worth anything real.
Well, that's true. I mean, even in the days of the gold standard, don't forget banks are lending far more out than they've actually got in the bank vault. So there's always going to be, any kind of banking operation at all implies that you're going to
this
be doing
that.
This
is what we're talking about, a run on the bank. That was when everybody tried to get their gold out together. They would find, there's not enough gold for everybody. So how does that principle work within banking then? Because there must be some rules
the term,
on the bank.
The term is fractional reserve banking. In other words, you've got to keep some proportion of the money available.
And isn't this called leverage? Am I right?
Well, leverage is how much more the money in circulation is than the actual monetary base. You know, the stuff that you've got to keep back for a rainy day.
Because I can remember years ago going into the Co-op Bank and having a rare chat with the manager there and saying to him, "This is in St Stephen Street here in Bristol," and saying, "Is it true that you make up money out of nowhere and lend it out at interest?" And he didn't look me right in the eye, but he looked at the floor and he said, "Well, actually, yes, it is."
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that actually what's been going on, and certainly one of the things leading up to the 2008 crash, is that banks were doing that in spades. So they only had a very tiny proportion.
The relationship between the money that you've got to keep back as a reserve and
now,
what you can
money,
lend out.
Is that money you've got to keep back, or is that actually gold or something that you've got to have an exchange for?
What it is more liquid assets. In other words, there are variety.
Is gold now right out of the picture?
No, gold isn't out of the picture, but gold isn't the only form of money either. I mean, silver could be used as money, weaponry, cigarettes, drugs, anything can be used as money. It's a question of whether people accept it or not. I can write you an IOU saying, "I owe you whatever I owe you, Tony," and as long as a third person will accept that, then you could say that that's conceptual money. But it's all based on trust, isn't it?
I mean, I can remember reading about something called tally sticks, and Bill Steele's documentary, the US writer, he wrote about this too. This is a tally stick, which was a carved stick of wood, which was split by the Treasury back in hundreds of years ago into two pieces of wood, and that stick, the half stick, the reason they split it was so they could match it again, if just to make sure it was the genuine stick, and that stick of wood was spent into the economy.
Yeah, Well, in other words, that just shows you how conception, anything can be accepted as money, which people will accept as money. Now, then you've got things which are very, very acceptable, like a piece of gold, and other things like a stick, which may or may not be acceptable, depending upon the social relationships surrounding the stick. I mean, any old stick won't do, will it?
I suppose the ultimate test is that if the king says it's, or, you know, the government says this is money, then it is. I mean, that was probably the most extreme version.
In other words, even in the freest markets, you've got some kind of government intervention underpinning the concept of the market. I mean, most markets in Britain, for example, grew up by royal charters being given to boroughs to have markets on certain days. And basically, it was illegal to buy and sell apart from in markets to ensure things like taxation was carried out properly and so on and so forth. So there's always, and you can say, well, why don't we just have a complete free market and keep the state out of it? Well, a complete free market with no state in it means I can come round and put my gun to your head and take the stuff off you, and that's a free market. Because unless there's a rule, then there are no rules. And once you've got rules, who makes those rules? That'll be the state then.
Well, the reason we're so dependent on money nowadays is, of course, because most of the land is in a very few people's hands, and most people don't actually own their own working place or even their own home. Much of our property, you know, home properties are mortgaged too. So we're going to talk a little bit about land rights and how that relates to the resources under our feet, you know, and having access to resources after some music.
Boys and girls, London calling. Now don't look to us, phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in, meltdown expected, the wheat is going in. Engines stop on him, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. I live by the river, to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. London calling to the zombies of death, quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't wanna shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice is just coming, the sun's zooming in, engines stuck on him, the wheat is going thick, a nuclear error. But I have no fear, cause London is drowning. It's gonna be a nuclear error, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. It was true. London calling at the top of the dial, and after all this, won't you give me a smile? London calling. I never felt so much alike.
Well, we were talking about the 1980s there, and that was The Clash from Summertime in the 1980s there with London Calling. Martin, we've been discussing a lot of this stuff to do with money, but I mean, I do always try and remind you and everyone else that actually money is just a sort of token to get access to resources. For most of us, we don't have any access directly to resources, the most important of which, of course, is, you know, the land, to either have a resource of a building, a workshop to work in, a home to live in, or the natural resources to sort of grow food or have access to minerals. All these kinds of things have slowly been taken away from us over the years. And I just wonder, you know, what your thoughts are about how we have slowly over the centuries become so utterly dependent on money for our day-to-day lives.
Well, I mean, that is the development of modern capitalist society, including the removal of people's land rights who were in the way of it, like, I don't know, Indian tribes in North America, etc. Of course, we all need access to resources, but in the kind of society we now live in, that is mediated largely by money. That doesn't mean that land is not still an issue. Most people on the planet still live in rural areas. I think we've got more people living in urban areas now than in rural areas for the first time in history. It happened a few years ago. But nevertheless, still a large number of people are still living in rural areas. And the situation there is deteriorating because people's rights to access to land are being undermined or they've never had them.
Well, we hear very little about it here in Britain. But in Latin America, for example, it's a massive movement. The Movimento Sem Terra, for example, which is the landless movement in Brazil, is an enormous movement of people, which is, you know, literally been happening over the last 20, 30 years, where the unemployed people from the cities and from rural populations have been taking over vacant land. Because we've got landowners now who've got vast, literally thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres of land, which although they have the property title to it, they don't necessarily use it. So just take us over to Brazil. I mean, what is going on over there?
Well, I mean, in the this is all to do with the political economy of the historical political economy of Latin America compared to other regions. I mean, it was essentially colonized by the conquistadors who dished it out as what they called encomiendas to the various banditti that made up the ruling class.
I mean, this happened in the United States too, surely. And here, you know,
it didn't. In the United States, differently, there was a frontier which was developed by owner farmers, and of course there were big landowners, and they tended to be controlling things like canals and railways. Whereas in Latin America, historically, it was the Spanish colonialism. The legacy of Spanish colonialism was a big landless population and very large latifundistas controlling it. You see, if you compare Latin American countries with Southeast Asian countries, there was land reform in all the Southeast Asian tiger countries, as they call them, the ones that managed to actually industrialize after World War II. So we're talking about Japan, Taiwan, the South Korea, Singapore, and so on.
And how did that land reform manifest itself then?
Well, basically, in the 1940s, because Japan was defeated, let's use that as an example, and that the old feudal ruling class had been very much part of the problem as far as the new American occupying authorities were concerned, they were very keen to see their power undermined. And one of the ways of doing that was just to give the land to the tiller, as they call it, in the those who were actually making, you know, actual farming livings. And the political power of the old ruling elite in Japan had been very undermined by a couple of atom bombs, and therefore it was possible to carry it through. And at that stage, the Americans, the US, was quite keen to see land reform as a means of, you know, preventing old elites from coming back and starting a militarist resurgence.
But bringing it back here to Britain, I mean, we had a civil war in the mid 1600s, the 17th century, between what was essentially the previous king and the feudal classes and the new merchant classes. Surely, I mean, that should have happened here.
Well, I mean, the modern historiography disputes the simplisticism of that analysis, but I think it's broadly correct. Don't forget that land reform didn't take place here. The old guard were back in power very soon after the republic was created here. and land remained very much in the hands of a minority, and it still is.
One of the things that did happen after the English Civil War, which took place between... It's interesting, actually, sometimes you ask people, you know, do you know when the English Civil War was? A lot of English people simply do not know the years, the century even, was between 1642 and 1649, a really horrendous half of a decade, a bit more than actually than half of a decade, where the initial spark behind it was the dispute between Parliament and the King. The King had decided that he was going to... One of the reasons that it happened, I mean, there's lots of different reasons, but one of them was that the King had actually begun to fine landowners retrospectively for enclosing their land, that is to say, privatising land. So much of what government seems to do is actually privatising things for the wealthy against the interests of the poor, and actually that's what had been happening in the run-up to the Civil War. So enclosure, but I mean, whatever you say and think about the causes of the Civil War, it's absolutely clear that the privatisation of land, enclosure of land, which had been common land before, massively accelerated after the Civil War, Martin.
It did, but I think seeing enclosure as a major cause of the English Civil War, I think, is simply erroneous historically. What you had was a dispute between, within the landowning classes, between very big landowners like the Earl of Warwick, who was Charles I's main opponent, and they basically were not prepared, and they basically controlled Parliament, both the House of Lords and the House of Commons, through patronage, and they were not prepared to allow the King his personal government, his personal rule. So eventually, it's essentially a squabble at the top which began the whole process. Of course, by the end of the Civil War, more radical demands had been made by the Levellers for one man, one vote, for example, apart from paupers, and by the Diggers for communalism in land. But they were very, very, very late developments. The beginning of the war was essentially a squabble at the top between grandees and the King.
Just a minute. I mean, I must put you straight on that, because the Levellers really began in 1645, which was halfway through the Civil War, and that was one of the Leveller cause was one of the ways that the parliamentarians, the Roundheads, actually got a lot of people on side. They said, "Well, we are accepting the Levellers as part of our movement."
No, that's not true. What actually happened was the Levellers managed to have gain influence within the New Model Army. And in actual fact, in terms of the society at large, they probably had relatively small influence.
Well, they had, for example, they were electing soldiers to represent them on the Council of the Army, the Levellers.
That's right, yes. So in other words, the Levellers' influence was very strong in the army, the New Model Army, which had won the Civil War.
And it was,
but their strength in the wider society was much weaker.
And it was seen as a democratising the army, actually putting, you know, giving representatives from the individual regiments a place at the top table.
Well, so that was 16... there was the first of the term an agitator. Each regiment elected two agitators to represent it on the army councils. That was the first time the word agitator was ever used. So when you call somebody an agitator these days, it derives...
It's a reference right back to the English Civil War.
But I mean, I think the point is that we obviously focus in our day upon the Levellers, and some of us upon the Diggers, because they seem to prefigure our modern society.
Well,
and of course, Leveller ideas, if you like, became the kind of leading ideas in the US, the American Revolution, which happened in the following generation. But of course, at the time, their real influence in the society was much smaller than we now see. We identify with them because it seems that their ideas were destined to win.
But
at the time, nobody necessarily thought that.
But it's a bit like
these
the
new
Chartists.
Ideas were very important,
Martin.
But they were not as dominant as we like to think.
It's a bit like the Chartists, isn't it? I mean, they had ideas at the right time. They didn't necessarily see their ideas put into action in their own lifetimes.
Right.
Those ideas kept going.
That's right. And I think there's always a tendency when we're looking at history for us to I read a lot of history, and what's fascinating about history is how much people are the same, how much things don't change really, and that the same sorts of things keep recurring, but almost also how much things do change, how varied human societies are, how the mental space of a previous generation is so difficult to capture. And of course, that's what all the best history does. It shows you how things are the same, but it also shows you how things were different. And the fact of the matter is that most people during the Civil War period probably didn't identify with either faction, They certainly didn't necessarily think of demanding some kind of utopian democratic society. There was a minority of radicals who envisioned something like that, but the vast majority probably tried to get through each day hoping that they weren't going to get some horrible disease or that their children weren't going to die.
Well,
that's the reality of history.
I go back to my main point, really, which is that the English Civil War, within the few decades afterwards, we saw a massive increase, systematic privatisation of Britain's land, a lot of people being dispossessed after that. And I would suggest to listeners, if you want to get it a little bit of entertaining education on how the English Civil War affected families, exactly what Martin was just saying there, the way that one part of the family might be on one side, another on the other side, great deal of confusion, a lot of heartache. There was a BBC series back in the 1980s called By the Sword Divided, which is you can get on DVD for £10-15 or something, which is a really good entertaining but educational too look at how some of the ruling families in the land were affected by, and by how ordinary people were affected by some of the Civil War divisions, the fissures that went right through society. But enclosure started in England, privatisation of land, back in many years before, which was around 1235. Something called the Statute of Merton was one of the first ever, if not the first, land privatisation, enclosure of land. We then had, under Henry VIII, through the 1530s and into 1540, the dissolution of the monasteries. And then in the run-up to the Civil War, 1549, 100 years before Kett's Rebellion. Now, Amanda Martin, do you know much about Kett's Rebellion? Because I find that this is a fascinating couple of months in the history of Norfolk, which very few people are told about.
It's a rebellion against what you described as privatisation of land, which is essentially enclosure. Prior to the Kett's Rebellion and many years before that, people basically all had some rights in the local community. And with improvements in agriculture and a more capitalistic approach to farming, eventually, step by step, the land was enclosed.
But you might say improvements. You see, a lot of the peasants would say actually what they were doing wasn't improving things for us at all.
Well, it wasn't, but at the same time, in terms of agricultural output, it was an improvement. So we're talking about exactly the amount of stuff that was produced. I mean, in other words, it's improvement in the sense in which we use it in the 20th and 21st centuries. We've got more output. Whether that output is properly distributed is another question.
But the thing is with Kett, I mean, one of the reasons I find it so fascinating is because it's not really taught much. I mean, I certainly wasn't taught it at school about it, but it was where for 6 weeks the whole of East Anglia was basically run by this former landowner turned rebel, Robert Kett, from underneath a tree, because he found that the way that land was being privatised wasn't working for him as well as it, for most of the peasants in the area. So he became a sort of ringleader. And what they did there was they actually locked up the enclosing landowners that had gone before Kett in Norwich Jail for stealing the land. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, you can, I think, sympathise with their view, is that this used to be our land. You've gone through some complicated process in Parliament, which where we don't, as peasants, have a vote, and you've now taken our land. We think you've stole it.
Yes, and people are always going to defend themselves when their livelihoods are at risk.
But it's almost
that's why we have class struggles throughout history.
But isn't it like the privatisation of water in the more recent years, and privatisation of electricity, these kinds of things which we used to own.
It is. I mean, people struggle over resources. They've always struggled over resources, and we're still struggling over resources now. But the fact of the matter is that historically speaking, he was in power for how long? A few weeks, a few months.
Yes, 6 weeks. I'm afraid, exactly. Before he was strung up. Strung up on the walls of Norwich.
Well, ultimately, that is not strong enough to beat the power configuration of the existing setup, is it? And there's a very interesting discussion in The World Turned Upside Down by Christopher
Hill
about the diggers and whether their ideas were in fact viable.
This is 100 years later in the Civil War.
This is the diggers who took over St George's Hill and wanted, basically land redistribution and common ownership of land. Now, he actually argues quite convincingly that it was a viable strategy, and that if it had been adopted, there would have been a different trajectory for the development of modern society in Britain. I'm open to that idea, but the fact of the matter was that they weren't strong enough, by any stretch of the imagination, to take on the existing power elites, and that's not the way that Britain developed at all.
I mean, was it another just a bit of centralisation of power before Kett, when Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries? Because all round here we've got, you know, all over Britain we've got these ruins of abbeys where there used to be a power structure of the church which farmed
in other words you went from being a peasant paying your dues to the church to being a peasant paying your dues to a secular landlord, and that secular landlord has a monetary attitude as well, unlike the church, and he's trying to improve his profits, and so ultimately basically, Britain developed the commercial capitalist ethic faster and in a more complete way than anywhere else in the world, and then exported that to the United States, where it was planted absolutely virgin soil, in a sense, because there was no real strength of and there was no kind of social structure to prevent it from taking root. And this modern capitalist way of doing things, invented in Britain, exported to the United States, has now become the way of doing things all over the world, and with all of the consequences that we know.
Well, this is capitalism, isn't it? And it was sort of took off after the 17th century Civil War. I wonder whether, is it stretching a point to say, well, we wouldn't have been able to have the Industrial Revolution here if we hadn't kicked the peasants off the land and had factories
This is the nub of the discussion in Christopher Hill about the viability of what the diggers were asking for. Now, because capitalism developed in Britain by kicking everybody off the land, it's become a kind of axiomatic idea that that's what's got to happen if you're going to have a modern society. Now, in actual fact, if you look at what happened in the United States, that wasn't the case. In actual fact, you've got lots of small farmers there in the United States because of the social structure. That's not what happened in Germany or in Japan. You don't, in fact, get rid of the existing farming set up, you improve and basically modernize it. So you've still got, and the same was true in France. So the British model of kicking everybody off the land and then industrializing, it's basically a one-off.
Because I know
nobody else
can
do it like that.
In France and Italy, you'll still find there's a lot of what people would call peasants, small owner occupiers.
Yes, well, I mean, the biggest peasantry still existing in Europe, a real peasantry, is in Poland. And in fact, I was writing a PhD thesis about the Polish agriculture in the 1990s, which I never completed. But, I mean, the point is that you can have a peasant agriculture and industrialization simultaneously. The most recent example of that has been in China, where township and village enterprises created 15 million jobs a year through the 1990s and into the 2000s, and they're all basically and the whole thing is based upon the complete land reform that took place in China in the 1940s. The existing ruling class were basically liquidated. They didn't just take the land off them, they got rid of them altogether by very nasty means, effectively. But the point is that you can have a viable peasant agriculture as a basis for an industrialization strategy. So the British way of doing things, kick them all off the land and then put them in factories, is not necessarily the way to go. What you do is you create a viable peasant agriculture and then you bolt proper industrialization onto the top of that. And this is what Latin America has lacked. Latin America has never had a proper land reform, and therefore you've got a totally skewed social structure with a tiny minority with loads of money and a majority with no land and no money.
Okay.
And that's not what you need.
Well, really, in the mid 1700s, 1650s, enclosure privatization of land really took off, and towards the tail end of it, the 1880s, there was a lot of disturbance, wasn't there, in Scotland and in Ireland over enclosure, and basically the people, I mean, we had the Irish potato famine, for example, which caused a massive, massive heartache, and also mass immigration, of course, over to America. Now, something happened there, didn't it, where in Ireland people really started fighting back. They did so in the Highlands in Scotland as well in the 1880s, but in Ireland this fight back actually happened at Westminster as well, because the Irish were sending MPs to Westminster. Now, this was a big change in Ireland. It meant that people who had been tenants of absentee English landowners, people who actually lived in London but owned land in Ireland, who were absolutely impoverished by the famine, paying all of their wealth in rent and none able to actually improve their own situation, living in hovels, were able to buy and build their own property. That is to say, get government cheap, virtually no interest loans to buy their own property and to build it. And that's why we've got a very different situation in Ireland now with lots of small owner occupiers.
Well, that's right, and these struggles over land go on all over the world, even as we speak.
I'm talking about Southern Ireland, of course, because, yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that we were discussing recently was that the Irish actually set up the Irish Republic, the Free State, and the Irish Republic was because the English weren't making as much money as they had been out of Ireland, out of being landowners.
Well, I mean, the landowning class, the Protestant ascendancy, as it was called in Ireland, has been on the retreat for over 200 years. And one of the great victories was in the 1880s with the land reform. And that then led on towards demands for home rule in the run-up to the First World War, which led on to the 1916 Rising and so on. Struggles over land remain important all over the world. We are somewhat divorced from them in modern Britain because we're several generations away from those struggles. But they are, in fact, of course, still very much to the fore in many parts of the world.
OK, Martin, thanks very much. We'll be back after the news. Before that, a little bit of music.
In the chilly hours and minutes of uncertainty, I want to be in the warm hold of your love and mine. To feel you all around me and to take your hand along the sand. I bet I may as well try and catch the wind. When sundown pales the sky, I want to hide a while behind your smile, and everywhere I'd look, your eyes I'd find. For me to love you now would be the sweetest thing. 'Twould make me sing. I bet I may as well try and catch the wind. All my blues behind. For standing in your heart is where I want to be and long to be. I bet I may as well try and